Let's talk about My Music and
Okay.
how you first got in, how you got involved from that program from the start.
I got involved because David Franklin did 4 or 5 years of the show, and then he had was medically unfit to do any more, so they shifted around to find somebody else because they didn't want to change. You know, it's not one of those quizzes where you have guests and different people all the time. And I was working for BBC Transcription at that time, and I used to lunch with some of the fellows who recorded My Music. And I used to, at lunch, I used to sort of tell stories and things like that, and they realized that I might be suitable. So they tried me out, and Frank wasn't too rude to me, because he made fun of my clothes, because I do tend to wear rather loud clothes, like this waistcoat I'm wearing now. I was wearing this actually once when I met Julian Bream, a guitarist, and he looked at me and said, "Hello, Amos, you've got a drop of the old rough, buff carpeting from Harrods." So, anyway, Frank made fun of my clothes, but I asked him for advice after a couple of shows, and he says, "Well, frankly, dear boy, you're not quite very bright at the repartee, so you better stick with your stories." And so I stuck with my stories, and had a good time, and he was very, very nice. Great. Oh, sadness that he died.
Just last year, yeah. I spoke to him on the phone, because mm-hmm. His autobiography had come out, and I mm-hmm. thought it'd be a good time to do an interview, and unfortunately, in the time I had, he was too busy.
Yeah.
And so we talked about doing it next time, and then 2 months later.
A Dicky Ticker. Mm. Yeah, he was great fun, and he used to sing quite well, some of the numbers, My Old Dutch. It was terribly nice. And sometimes it could be very funny. You know, when you're doing a radio show like that, you can sometimes talk while they're playing a musical illustration. And one time we'd been discussing on the program the deaths, strange deaths of certain composers. You know, one chanson fell off his bicycle, and César Franck got hit by a bus, and things like that. And Lully stamping on his foot. Then they played a bit of music, and I said, "It's a pity, Frank, I couldn't mention Donizetti, but it's perhaps a little bit too rude for our radio." "Oh, what happened to Donizetti?" "Well, he had a nervous breakdown, and he got weaker and weaker, and he could not stop masturbating. And he masturbated so much that he weakened himself to the point of death." "Oh," said Frank, "then you might say Donizetti died by his own hand." But he had a wonderful sense of humour. Once, after the show, I said, "What are you doing in the summer?" And he said, "Well, I've rented a villa in Corsica for 3 months." I said, "Oh, really? What would you be doing there?" He said, "Well, I've got to finish a novel. I'm a very slow reader." That's typical Frank. Wonderful to work with. And I love working with Dennis. Dennis is amazing, that brain that sort of ticks over at such speed, and he never goes from point A to point B, but he goes via L and Z and whatever. Once I finally recognized a piece of music as being Bartok, The Miraculous Mandarin. "Oh," said Dennis, "I've always wanted to know, is that the sequel to A Clockwork Orange?"
Oh, jeez.
I mean, you know, just off the top of his head.
Right.
Couldn't have known that in advance. And one time in the warm-up for the first show, somebody said, "Oh, Dennis, what's your definition of a haggis?" And he said, "Oh, it's a moussaka of Glencoe," which might appeal to get through to some of your Scottish dissented people in America.
How was that show produced? Was it just done straight through?
We used to go there, have a drink at the BBC's expense, then we go on and record one show, and then the technical check-up, make sure we got something on the tape. And then we did the second one. And then we went home after another drink at the BBC's expense. It was very simple to do, and it was extremely easy to do, because we didn't meet, funnily enough. I occasionally would see Ian Wallace, perhaps once or twice a year, because we knew a lot of musical people in common. But I had nothing, no friends in common with Dennis and Frank. And so we didn't meet. So that when we did meet, it was an occasion. You, as an interviewer, I'm sure you know that it's much better to meet somebody point blank. I mean, you know, rather than sort of... there's some people who always say, oh, if you're doing this interview, could we have lunch beforehand? And I say, well, if you absolutely must, but it's much better because you get a genuine encounter.
Right. One of the worst experiences, well, it wasn't worse in the sense of really terrible, but most disappointing experiences I had was the second interview I did with someone I got to know rather well after the first interview. Mm-hmm. And it was, he sort of said, well, was seemed to be saying, well, you know the answer to this. Why should I say it's much? Quite.
As I was saying in the lift coming up, one chap, Wilfred Van Wyck, an agent, just as the red light went on, it tells you how long ago it was, he said, I say, Amos, you're not going to bowl any fast ones, are you? So, bowl me a fast one.
Now, Steve Race was the host and compiler of
That's
the
right.
questions for the
Absolutely
entire run.
Absolutely brilliant in doing medleys of tunes.
Oh, the medleys were fantastic.
One tune with the left hand and the other with the right. Poor chap, he's gone awfully deaf. He got so deaf that the only way you can really get through to him is on the telephone. Telephone is okay for deaf people. I know, because I'm a bit deaf myself. But he got so fed up with this that he sold his piano and he sold all his records and his music and everything.
Well, you know, in fact, I talked to him when I was here last time, too, yeah. And he said, well, that's in the past and I really don't want to do an interview about it, which I was sorry to hear. Your stories were wonderful. I remember especially the stories about Beecham. You seem to have an inexhaustible supply of stories about Beecham.
Well, you know, one of his secretaries, Dr. Bertha Geismar, who previously been with Furtwängler, she started collecting stories about Beecham. She had a manuscript with about 350 stories about Beecham. And it got lost. Don't know where it's gone.
Oh.
But, you know, when I worked with Beecham, did you know I worked with
No,
Beecham?
I didn't.
I worked with Beecham for a couple of years as his concert manager. I was also called advisor to Sir Thomas Beecham. Can you imagine advising Sir Thomas about anything, let alone music? Anyway, when I talked to him, you know, we used to go on journeys in the car somewhere, and I would say, Sir Thomas, that story about you going down Regent Street on a hot day with an overcoat, and you stop a taxi and throw the overcoat into the taxi and say to the driver, follow me. He said, no, that's not true. He said, I've heard that story when I was a child. It's probably about F.E. Smith or Disraeli or, you know, somebody like that. But some of the stories were true. The thing is that when I worked for him, nothing terribly funny occurred. He was witty sometimes. He would save it up. When he was talking to the musicians, there was some electricity, like being in the quiz show, My Music. There was some electricity that set him off. But a lot of his jokes were, you know, I thought a bit daft, jokes about people's names. What is your name? Ball, Sir Thomas. How very singular. One should never make jokes about people's names. But sometimes things happen. I was once at a rehearsal, and it started at 10 o'clock, and about 10:15, he stopped the orchestra and said, second trumpet, too loud. And there was a bit of zzzz going on. He said, what's going on over there in the brass? First trumpet got to his feet and said, well, Sir Thomas, the second trumpet hasn't arrived yet. Oh, has he not? Well, when he does show up, tell him not to play too loud. Brilliant. You see, because most conductors, if they make a boo-boo, you know, they go on conducting one bar too many or something like that, or don't know that the clarinets should be in A-flat, in A, not in B-flat. It's marked down and remembered. But Beecham could turn a minus into a plus. And I think he did quite a lot of harm to all the other conductors. Not only because of that, but because his rehearsals were such fun. You know, 3 hours would pass, and they'd say, good Lord, you know, is it lunchtime already? But we've just been enjoying ourselves and just playing and making music. And that was his great strength. He made music. He didn't boss. He treated musicians as equals and as people who knew their job as well as he knew his. Of course, you know, if there's a bit of trouble, he could pull rank. Just as royalty. Have you ever interviewed royal people?
No.
Because if anything goes wrong, then they immediately get on their high horses, and their horses are fairly high.
Did you have an experience like that?
Yes, I've had a brush or two with Prince Charles. One time I was connected with the English Chamber Orchestra and there was a dinner, fundraising dinner. And afterwards he said, "Oh, you're here, Amos. Well, you should have made the speech, not me." So I said, "I know my place, sir." "Do you think I don't?" Riposted the prince. Ooh, oi, oi. No, I don't mind.
Let's talk a bit about your your own musical career.
Well, I'm practically uneducated. I've you know, there are some people who benefit from being in an institution and working to a framework. And I'm one of the sort of slightly bolshy ones. I agree with Holst, who said never learn anything unless not knowing it is a positive source of frustration. And I just picked mine up. I used to go to the library when I was a kid during the school holidays. I used to play the piano for about 8 hours a day, and go to the public library and start with Albinus and finish with Zandonai. And I played anything and everything, and I got to know a hell of a lot of music. And then I worked in a record shop, and I was able to take the records home, and again, learnt a hell of a lot. But I specialised at that time in orchestral music and piano music. Those were what interested me. And then other things came later, like opera and songs and Lieder. And eventually I had my voice trained, but failed to make it as a concert singer. I had about 15 auditions, and they all said, "Critic, are you a broadcaster? Continue." Charming. And they were probably right. But, you know, it amused me to sing songs on my music, and I thought it was fun, and I liked that, and I quite enjoyed it, and didn't come out too badly.
So you were working for a long time with the BBC, aside from there?
Yes, I was never on their staff. That's not true. I was advisor to the boss of BBC Transcription for 5 years. But apart from that, I've always been a freelance. And that seemed to work better. Don't get any work from them now, because they I think they've sort of crossed everybody over 60 off their books. They're lost.
In the series that I first heard that you were involved with BBC was it called Talking About Music?
That's right. They pinched old Anthony Hopkins's title, because he'd had a series talking about music for years on British radio. But the boss of Transcription said, "No, that'll be a good title for abroad, because they don't have Hopkins over there." So I used it. It was fun. It enabled me to interview anybody, more or less, that I liked, and to do little features on Bayreuth or Vienna or Budapest or whatever. And I knew a lot of musicians to start with, and musicians like being interviewed. They like the chance, you know, as in my music, to be a little Lord Fauntleroy.
I mean, when did you start doing accents?
Voices? Accents. Well, that comes from my family. My father and his two brothers all spent a year in Germany and France. And so at Christmas time and, you know, family meetings, they always put on German accents and French accents and things like that. And so it just sort of continued. When I'm in Australia and talk with what I think is an Australian accent, they say, "Are you from South Africa, Squire?" And vice versa. When I'm in South Africa, they think I must be Australian. But it's quite fun.
What are some of the memorable musicians that you've met and interviewed?
Gosh, well, you see, I also ran a summer school from 1948 for 34 years, and we had practically everybody in the business there. First year or so, we had Hindemith. Goes back as far as that. Hindemith and Enesco and Elizabeth Schumann. We had the Amadeus in their first year as a string quartet. And then, well, if I mention a few of the composers who came, I mean, not just artists, performing artists. Composers, we had Stravinsky, came for a week. Berio, Luigi Nono, Bruno Maderna. You remember Schmidt Iserstedt's old gag? "Musica moderna? No, no." Then we had, of the Americans, we had Copeland, came several times. Roger Sessions, Virgil Thompson came twice or three times. Boris Blacher, Fischer Dieskau came a couple of times. The Amadeus came about 20 times. Great days they were. And, you know, I was supposed to be in charge of them and push them on the platform or introduce them to the class or whatever. So I got to know all these people. And quite a few of the composers were my friends. Like Britten was a friend, and Walton and Tippett. Tippett I worked for as a kind of secretary in the days before he was at all well known, way back in the 1940s. And I used to go and see him in prison. You know, he was a conscientious objector.
Oh, yes.
And I went to see him there and managed to get Pierce and Britten to come to do a recital at Wormwood Scrubs, the prison, where Tippett was in drug. He took over the prison orchestra from Ivan Avello, who was there for fiddling...
For tax...
For petrol coupons. Fiddling off for the years off one. Pears and Britten came, and I got in as page-turner. And when we got there, we managed to persuade the chaplain that the music was so difficult to page-turn that we had to have two people. Where am I going to get anybody in amongst the screws who can turn pages for you? I said, well, it's actually 574302, Tippett M, could do it. And so for that concert, the only time I've ever seen it, we had two page-turners. Two performers and two page-turners.
Well, what a wonderful story. I've just been reading a bit in the new biography of Herbert von Karajan. Do you have any von Karajan stories?
No. I've read the biography and I found it absolutely fascinating. What an extraordinary man he was. I mean, what a manipulator. He was so Machiavellian that I think it's amazing that he was actually such a good conductor. I mean, I didn't like everything he did. I mean, nobody, I don't think, did. I didn't like his Mozart. But, I mean, most things he did sort of wonderfully. And he really sussed out the relationship between conductor and orchestra. And by having the Berlin Phil for so long, I mean, he only had to lift a little finger and the roof came down. That was an amazing rapport. And it is that kind of thought process that is one of the most important things, but not often talked about in music, I think. I mean, it's the same between performing artists. And Karajan says once, and he says, you sometimes, with an orchestra, you can make them change direction like a flock of birds, he says. And it's absolutely true. And how does a flock of birds wheel around? And how does an orchestra suddenly play louder, softer, whatever it is? Amazing. And it's thought process, isn't it? Concentration. But unless you have the talent, you stand in front of an orchestra, you're not going to get anything out of them at all. I once heard our late Prime Minister, Sir Edward Heath, conducting an orchestra, a youth orchestra, and he took over from Abado in the middle of a rehearsal. They'd been doing Mahler 6. Edward Heath immediately brought his baton down for the Meistersinger overture, and the sound suddenly changed from a really good symphony orchestra into a bad school orchestra, just in one chord. And I was once working for the London Symphony Orchestra, and during 1 week we had Pierre Monteux and Leopold Stokowski and another conductor who only made one record ever. He was hopeless. And there again, without saying anything, Monteux didn't say anything, and yet the music was immediately very French sound, transparent. You could hear every strand. Stokowski came 2 days later. He didn't say anything, he just conducted. And immediately the sound was thick and saturated and sonorous. Amazing. And this other tick, you know, it was just ghastly.
How do people get into those positions, people without talent?
I don't know. I suppose it's the power thing. Like politicians. Politicians get destroyed by this craving for power, don't they? Even if they start off honest, within 6 months they've gone. And conductors? Wow, it's amazing. And it's the thing you can do into your old age, isn't it? I mean, Stokowski, I went to one of his last sessions, and he was gaga. But, like Klemperer was also a bit gaga towards the end. But when their eyes opened and they focused, they could get the sound and they could get the shape of music. I mean, there's a record of La Lesienne Suite by Stokowski at 93. Just amazing vitality. Marvellous. And yet sometimes during the sessions his head would get lower and lower and lower, and then his face would go zonk onto the desk. They'd stop the recording, wave salvolatilly under his nose. He would recover, you know, like some creature in a sort of blood horror movie. Just received an injection or the midnight chimes or something, and he would carry on.
Did you ever think of conducting or try conducting yourself?
Yes, I conducted once. During the wartime, there was an orchestra of guardsmen and amateurs, and they were all cheesed off because, you know, music you could hear then was your 100 best tunes or your 20 best tunes. And so these guardsmen and everybody got a little amateur, it wasn't a professional orchestra, but a lot of them were professionals. And they said, right, John, next Tuesday, you're conducting the first two movements of Borodin Symphony No. 2 in B minor. And during the first movement, I knocked over the leader's stand 7 times. It cured me, you know. I wanted to be a conductor. I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful? I can do it. Anybody can do it. I couldn't. And it was a very good lesson. Mm. After that, I never bothered.
We're talking with John Amos. What are your reactions to what's going on today with both with the Royal Opera House, the mess there, and then also just the continuing discussion of whether London should have as many orchestras as it does?
Yes, people have tried to chop the orchestras, but, you know, we're very individual, egotistic, perhaps, people. And these orchestras, they seem to be getting into terrible financial troubles, and at the last moment, something happens, and they manage to save themselves. And you put any of these 5 orchestras under a good conductor, and they will make marvellous music. So, you know, I guess it's probably going to continue. The opera house is a dreadful mess. A year ago, as to say 1997, in 1997 it looked as if the English National was going to go under. But now what's happened is the Royal Opera House seems to be going under. I mean, talk about the Titanic. And it's really awful. I mean, that orchestra is so good and the chorus has got so good. John Vickers came all the way from Canada the other day and said, you know, why are you treating these people so badly? These are the people, they haven't done any harm, they haven't made a muddle. It's the administrators you should chuck out.
Right.
And the amount of money wasted. I went the other day to the first performance of Boris Godunov, and there was a special sort of high chair, like an umpire's chair in tennis, which must have cost about £1,000, I'm sure. And it just wasn't really needed. So ridiculous. And for some of the ring, they've got special boots, you know, fur boots, and they decide they don't like them, so they throw them all away. And they've had 70 pairs of boots made or something ridiculous. The waste is colossal. And I'm also, in my old age, I find myself railing against the standard of opera production. We get so many producers whose ego is so big, they won't learn the score and they won't respect the score. And they just think they know better and they sort of muck about with it. If they have real imagination and talent, then you get a marvellous production, as you did Visconti's Don Carlo, the best opera production I think I've ever seen. Peter Stein with the Welsh National, who did Othello and Peleus. Marvellous production. Peter Brook, stage production of Midsummer Night's Dream. People still remember it because it completely turned the play or the opera upside down. But they had a genius and a talent that was in some ways comparable to the original creator. But unless you do that, when I go to the opera and the curtain goes up and I see an iron bedstead halfway up the wall, I feel like saying, like Virgil Thompson used to say sometimes at the beginning of a piece of contemporary music, no good will come of this.
Well, I just remember seeing at the Royal Opera production, Gertz Friedrich production of Siegfried, which I thought was just the cheapest looking production I'd ever seen. I thought it was an embarrassment. I mean, it looked like some tacky fringe production, yet it was at the Royal Opera. The musically, if you did it with your eyes closed, fine.
But people bust a gut to reproduce what the composer wanted, the instruments, the intentions, everything. But they will be seen dead before they put in what the opera composer wanted to see on the stage. I mean, I've realized you don't want to see Hamlet done as it was done in 1561, or Wagner done as it was done in 1872, but you do expect a similar imaginative creation. I mean, just as you do with critics. Virgil Thompson used to say that, you know, you've got to give a performance.
Do you have any Noel Coward stories?
No, I'm afraid I don't. But I love them when I hear them.
Do you have any favorite of his songs?
Oh, there's so many favorites.
Yeah, it's hard to choose, isn't
it? Yeah. I'm sure you know all the Noel Coward stories. I mean, do you know the one when some idiot person committed suicide? And they said, oh, he shot his brains out. I had no idea he was such a good shot.
Yes, it's one of my favorites.
And the one going into Australia, when they said, we're immigration, could we ask you, Mr. Coward, do you have a prison record? And he said, I didn't realize it was still necessary.
the Australian one.
Have you not heard that one?
No, I hadn't.
Oh, that's great.
The Australian one I had
heard. You might guess.
It was when he was... Someone recognized him in the elevator, and he said, oh, Mr. Coward, say something funny. Kangaroo.
Yeah. Say something Australian.
Right.
Never correct anybody telling funny stories, but still, never mind. You know what I mean. No, I think he was great. I would love to have... I did meet him once. You know, he wrote a ballet. London Morning. London Glory.
Morning.
Yes. And it was orchestrated by Gordon Jacob. And at that time, the Beaverbrook press was terribly down on him. And as well as a few critics turning up for the press thing, some snotty little boy from Daily Express came and asked really nasty, rude questions about his play, saying, you know, well, emphasizing that the recent productions hadn't been successful and blah, blah, blah. And eventually Coward, very patiently, sort of gently, and then said, dear boy, which of my plays have you read? And it absolutely floored the bloke, because he hadn't read a single play. Oh, thank you, dear boy. Thank you. And I went to him afterwards, and I said, it seems to me terrible that you are, at the moment, the whipping boy. And he said, well, it is sad, considering this is my own country, and I've worked here for so many years, and tried to do my best. He said, but perhaps things will change. And they did, thank God. It was really terrible.
So did you see, you saw him perform? Or,
yes, I saw him on the stage once or twice, but I can't remember which plays anymore. But he was just a wonderful creature.
Now that my music is no longer in production, what kinds of things are you doing to keep busy?
Well, I do a kind of one-man show, which is also called, like my autobiography, A Miscellany. And I do that. And I do shows with various other people. I do a Flanders and Swan program, because I was at school. I was at prep school with Donald.
Oh, really?
Swan.
Oh.
And they started off their show, in a way, through the summer school that I used to run at Dartington. Donald used to come and help me with sort of tasks like putting up music stands, fixing the lights and so forth. And Flanders came too, and we used to have a cabaret on Friday evenings. And I said, would you like to perform one? Yes, of course we'll do it. And at that time, the only time they ever performed was at parties or for the benefit of people who were going to do their material in a show, somebody like Max Adrian, Joyce Grenfell. And so they did this Friday night cabaret, and it was an absolute rave. And people kept on saying to them, why not you do your own show in a theatre? Theatre came up available in Notting Hill Gate, a tiny little theatre. And so they borrowed our mailing list from the summer school, and a lot of our people turned up. And also critics turned up. because there was nothing doing on New Year's Eve that year. 56, I think, 1956. And they got rave reviews, and they took over in London, the Fortune Theatre. And as they always say in the penultimate chapter of detective stories, the rest you know.
Well, yes, I know. Just recently I got the complete, the boxed set now with all of it. That's the drop of a hat, the drop of another hat.
Three CDs.
Three CDs.
I wrote the liner notes, it so happens. I also do quite a lot of lecturing, music lecturing, on cruises. And in fact, this year, 1998, I've done 9. 4 in Russia, on the waterways. We have 2 days in Petersburg and 2 days in Moscow. And the rest of time on waterways. You go on the lake, you go on the Volga, etc. I've also did 4 this year on the Danube. We go to Budapest, Bratislava, and Vienna. And I talk about the operas they're going to see. And then I did one on the French boat called the Mermoz, where we had an incredible lineup. Yuri Bashmet, Vengerov.
Oh.
Symphonia Varsovia, conducted by Penderecki. The Moscow Soloists.
That's all?
Bashmet. What?
That's all?
several singers, about half a dozen pianists.
Wow.
Etc. Have
you heard Arkady Voloris?
No.
The pianist?
No.
Oh, he's this next century's really? Horowitz. He is absolutely fantastic.
Well, there's another one that comes on these cruises, a Turkish boy called Fazil Say. S-A-Y. Mm. And he is the nearest thing to Glenn Gould that I've heard.
Oh.
I mean, and he's...
I'm a passionate Glenn Gould fan.
But this boy is playing a Bach and Mozart. It's just sensational. Really wonderful.
Did you ever meet
Glenn
Gould? And
it annoys a lot of people, which is also the hallmark of a genius. There's always somebody who says, oh, Heifetz, he's so soupy. You know, but I think he's just divine, Heifetz.
Did you ever meet Glenn Gould?
No, but I corresponded with him. And he said, if I ever do another interview, it will be with you. But of course, he knew damn well he wasn't going to.
Well, I guess during the latter part of his life, he wanted to script the interviews anyway himself.
Yeah quite.
And he I heard him perform 3 times.
Yes. I was playing one of his records recently because I sometimes do... another part of my... I'm Gemini, you see, and so I spread myself over many aspects of music. I do narrations with piano and with orchestra, sometimes do The Young Person's Guide or Peter and the Wolf. But recently in Canada, I did Enoch Arden. Don't know whether you've ever come across that.
Well, yes, he recorded it with Claude Rains.
That's right.
Yes, that finally has been released on CD.
Yes, that's right. Well, I did it with a pianist there, and I did some Liszt recitations, and that's one of my things. I've got various people that I do shows with, and we pick a little living.
Well, John Amos, it's really been a delight to meet you after hearing you for all these years.
Well, it's nice to be interviewed by somebody who asks reasonably intelligent questions.
Well,
and
you.
Somebody who listens. Don't you find with interviewing, people sometimes say, how do you do it? You have to know your homework. Look and listen.
Listen.
Simple.
Right. Or my first axiom is shut up and listen.
Yeah, yeah.
Shut up to me.
Often you get interviewers who want to be the star.
Mm.
And that's not the point of the exercise, is it? Anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.